I've played with the traffic many times, though.
In traffic. Yeah.
Traffic can be a basic, good basic first track if you want to overdub other stuff, because it's kind of organic. It sounds like the ocean. Well, I have cards here to sort of, because I play music and stuff, and I sometimes would have lists when I go out to play. And it was suggested that I have kind of an order for this. So this is the introduction. I was born in Philadelphia in 1943. and my father was a minister, and my mother played the violin and sang in choirs and played the piano, and I probably got all my music from her. I don't think I got anything from my dad, like music-wise. I think he might have been tone deaf. He wore a hearing aid, and he was a minister, but he would pretend to sing the hymns and stuff, but he was always like a word behind or something, so I know he wasn't really singing. So that was a great lesson to me. I used to see a halo over his head sometimes if I stared long enough, while he was preaching. I don't think if you stare at me long enough and then look up into the sky over Vincent's head, you may see a halo over my head. If so, I guess my job's done. I've been a saint. Okay, church. That's where, the music I heard growing up, I could take my glasses off it. It's like, music in church. And my mother played the violin. She played in Civic Symphony. She played in the Civic Symphony in Medfield, Massachusetts. I remember going to see her play. And here in Gloucester, too, there was a Gloucester Civic Symphony. And so I heard stuff like Rhapsody in Blue and things like that. And I really liked Rhapsody in Blue and a lot of the old standards. But that was a pretty good one. I probably swiped a few of those licks here and there. I never planned on being like a rock and roll singer. I used to love listening to the radio. And I think my first favorite real singer was Johnny Ray. And I used to like to sing his songs. I used to do imitations of Johnny Ray from my brother and sister. And I would roll around on the floor and rip my shirt. Because he was like a real emotional performer. He broke down the barrier between like all the old crooners and the rock and roll guys who would have come later and just break it up. And he used to break it up. His big year was like 1952. But I can remember, walking around by myself singing his songs to myself, not to anybody else. If there's anybody else around, I would probably stop. But I keep forgetting that I used to sing when I was a boy. And I sang in choirs, but that was something different, And then when I got to be a teenager, when I was, we left Gloucester in 1955, moved to East Providence, and the first two rock and roll songs I ever heard, I heard them here. I was listening to this guy said, "You gotta join the National Radio Fan Club," and they were playing. They were still playing all this, how much is that doggy in the window kind of junk. But then they played Fats Domino's "Ain't That a Shame," and that was probably the first rock and roll record I ever heard, and Tutti Frutti, and those were like it was like the shot heard around the world. It was just, there was nothing else like it. I mean, I liked some swing music. There was a babysitter who left some 78s at our house once. And I'm nervous as crap. And there was this 78 called by Harry James. He used to play with Benny Goodman, trumpet player. And one side was Easter Parade, which was this schlocky, just schmaltzy thing, which, played a million times too. But that was the big hit. The other side was called Crazy Rhythm. And I just loved the shit out of that one. It was like the introduction on that was just so convoluted, and it just catapulted you into this thing, and it just kept the beat was crazy. It was called Crazy Rhythm, and that was probably the big record of my life. And the other song I really I would spin around the room and go dance around the table to was a Carillon of the Bells, you know, that da 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 da. So cyclical stuff like that always moved me. And then rock and roll, you know, when that came up on the radio, it was like, I couldn't wait to get home from school and turn the radio on and listen to that. And I guess every 10 years, something really fantastic was happening when I was growing up. You know, the doo-wop, rock and roll, R&B stuff in the 50s, and then in the 60s, the British invasion was really exciting. And then in the 70s, the punk rock stuff, or whatever you want to call it. And then in the 80s, the rap stuff. And then the 90s, you know, it kind of was going all the different places. I'm not sure what I was crazy about there. Maybe it was me hearing more world music for a change, perhaps. But where do I go from here? How do you write songs? That's why I'm here. How do I write my songs? If you have any specific questions.
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
In your origin story.
All right.
You were born in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And then you say, and then when we moved out of Gloucester in 55 or whenever it was to East Providence, but I didn't catch the transition between Philly and...
I think we moved from Philly to maybe my aunt and uncle's farm for a while in New Hampshire. Uh-huh. They weren't really farmers, but they had a place there. Yeah. And then Medfield, Massachusetts was the first place I really remember. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, Massachusetts town next to Walpole.
No, I know where
it is. But, you know, I had my radio. My grandfather had he was like a ham radio guy, so he always, you know, I had a nice Zenith radio next to my head all the time. I used to, you know, the best days were when you pretended you were sick and you stayed home because you knew something was coming in the mail from H.G. Harris Stamp Company and you could just listen to the radio all day and get 1,000 stamps for a dime. So, it was good. It was a real good deal. And they were real, I think. I filled up whole books for them. This all has everything to do with songwriting, because everything in your life, it goes in. It comes out in some form, I think. Where else? I mean, I don't really make up stuff. I tried to use a little discipline once. Somebody said you should be disciplined and you know, like try and write a song a day. And you know, they don't all have to be the Mona Lisa. Which is a good thought, you know. They don't all have to be masterpieces, you know. Some are better than others, supposedly. But, you know, those disciplined ones where I just was doing it for an exercise, I only used one of them called Telephone Sex. And I got most of the lyrics right out of the ads in the newspaper. So that's another good source material.
You know?
Both, actually.
Another thing.
Did we get here?
You said that hearing a couple of songs in Tutti Frutti and another one sort of opened.
Ain't That a Shame?
Ain't That a Shame?
They were the first ones ever. I mean, the first rock and roll songs, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard.
Yeah. Well, I took the Sun Studios tour in Memphis. I'm sure everyone does, and I think that, Elvis Presley singing Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog, that's arguably the first rock and roll song, but Big Mama Thornton had done it previous. Anyhow.
Much better. His is great.
It might have been in Brett Milano's book, but the logo comes from jazz musicians that
No, I was hanging out when I was in high school. I was hanging out. Well, I was going to the 47 Club in Cambridge for the jazz on the weekends.
Is that Club Passim now?
Yeah. And then they had a kunga player, a kungero from New Haven named Bill Fitch. And I got to be pals with him. And then he brought another musician into town from Harlem, actually. His name was Don Elias. And these guys were friends. And they all had nicknames. They were more ethnic kind of nicknames. Bill Fitch was Chalito. No, Don was Chalito, and Bill Fitch was Macondo. But I decided to combine this timbale player Willie Bogo and Joe Loco, a Cuban pianist. So it became Willie Loco. And it's good to have a fake name because it served me well 20 years later. And still, I mean, if you have a name like, you know, Willy Loco, you can just play anything you want.
Really, we had one call from through the web when they heard that Willie Alexander was going to be here, and they wanted to know
if it's the same one.
Willie Alexander. Well, I guess it's in Portland or something. So.
What's that? There's another one.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
There are a lot of Willie Alexanders in the world.
Yeah,
that's is a singer or something.
Poet.
A poet, yeah.
Really?
West Coast language poet, right?
Whoa.
Black guy.
Surrealist.
Yeah, there are a lot of black Willie Alexanders. A lot of them are in the armed services and stuff like that.
They
found out.
You up,
Willie. Well, you know, my dad was from Montgomery, Alabama, so maybe I'm from South too. Wasn't South Philly.
What about Frankie Lyman and Bill Haley and the Comets? Are they rock and roll? That was my
favorite. Yeah, yeah. The Frankie Lyman's Why Do Fools Fall in Love was one of the first big rock and roll records, and that was a great one. And it's mostly the harmonies were like something you may have heard in the swing era and the Ink Spots and stuff like that. But when that saxophone solo came in the middle, you knew you were in another territory, you know. And that was all, most of the rock and roll in the 50s that I started listening to, they all had saxophone solos. The only guitarists I could think of that meant anything to me would be like Chuck Berry, and he was more of a songwriter, and Bo Diddley and Mickey Guitar Baker, but there's blues guys, but I hadn't heard a lot of that. Although the rhythm and blues disc jockeys would play some of those guys, but it was mostly saxophone. And I didn't get to play with a saxophone until 1968. Why am I running out of breath? I was in a band called the Bagatelle, and there was a tenor player, an alto player in that. But now I play with lots of saxophones now. What do you want me to do now? Henry, well, here's...
What about that?
Here, look at my list here.
You have that...
Introduction, huh?
You're going to cue up that first song.
Oh, is that so embarrassing? Maybe I should play it, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, I could play the first... the first record I was ever on. I was in a band called The Lost, and we formed at this college up in Vermont. And
what year was that, Bill?
Well, we started playing gigs in 1964. This came out in 1965, and this was a big hit in like Puerto Rico and Worcester and like four or five places. It's 1 minute and 54 seconds. I'm singing lead on this one. A lot of words in this one.
Make the same thought that I got nothing else to do. But listen to words that only come from just a few. But I can scream to sound just like a band. I'll do what I can do and take the thorn out of your hand.
Will and Kirk influence. It's Kyle Garahan. So those.
Now, a slide whistle in there?
Now that's an example of like a fast song with a lot of words. Sometimes a slow song, you don't have to have all those words. Wow. There's, I'll play a little bit of number eight. It's called Everybody Knows, which was sort of like the second song I ever wrote, or maybe I always say it's the first one. This is a love song. When you write songs, you write love songs because, like, your heart is breaking, or your heart is bursting, or it's unrequited, or it's requited, or it's over, or it's going through stuff, and it's always good source material.
Same album.
Yeah. This album didn't come out until, like, 40 years after the band had long been gone.
2006.
Yeah, you couldn't put an album out for Capitol Records in the 60s without having three hit singles, and then you could put an album out. That was the rule. I still do this one. And I recorded it through three different bands. It's about Susie Zuckerman. I think Ted Myers helped me with the chord progression.
Did you sing it?
Yeah, but the heartache was my own. Do I still sing the same way, you guys? I mean, like that first song.
Did you ever play that first song live?
I did it once in New York for the Yola Tango people. They learned it, so I had to do it. Just like Walk Away Renee, they learned that.
How'd it go?
It was good. I had to learn it, you know. Had the lyric sheet. There's a rumor that the real kids are learning this one.
They'll never approach that church.
Funky Potatoes did a recording of this. That's a band that was led by Billy Briggs, who was a keyboardist for The Remains.
Boston area?
Yeah. Man, that's still a good song.
You know, Willie, it's really nice that the words are important enough for you to really I love.
That's because I didn't mix it, I guess.
I mean, that doesn't happen all the time.
You're right. Where's it? Well, it's like when I made my first solo album, and I played it for my friend Dirty Eddie. He says, you know, I can't hear the vocals like on the MCA stuff. Or the MCA stuff, the vocals are like, you know, way out in front. And it's like, you know, when I did my solo album, it's, I don't know why I had just bathed myself in all kinds of echo and just murk and stuff. I don't know if I was trying to hide it. I mean, I liked the mix, and it might have had something to do with my, you know, alcohol and drug intake. Then I thought it was good at the time, and I stood by it, and I still do. But then the guy that I recorded it with, he remixed the whole thing, like, 20 or 30 years later for a Japanese company without me there, and did it objectively, like just some new band walking into the room, and just, you know, he put things and there's stuff I buried, but also the stuff I said get rid of, they didn't. I hadn't got rid of them. So I had these long ass endings and just all this, just a whole lot of stuff that I thought was too much. And I didn't want to be like, you know, a solo album. It's like, you know, you just, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, where you just overdo everything. You know, it's like 8-minute songs that could really be better if they were like 3 or 2.5. Like those two songs by The Lost.
Indulgent,
yes. Right. Yes, I didn't want to be too, I thought I was, you know, being, not being, by saying, yeah, get rid of that. Take that ending off, chop this, chop that. And they put them in again, you know, for the new, it's called Solo Loco Redux. And I love those endings because they were like, wow, this is good stuff. I'm glad they lied to me and said, you know, because that's the way, usually I recorded a bunch of stuff and then a process of elimination. I record a lot and then just throw stuff away. It's like when I was doing that solo album, I'd I'd go in, and sometimes I'd play the drums for 20 minutes, and then I'd get two tracks out of that. And the first I got a 6/8 thing, and I got a 4/4 thing. The 4/4 thing ended up as Bebopalula. I had this beat, and then I put the electric piano through a pig-nose amplifier, distorted crap out of it, and it put like three layers of this weird piano. And it was just two chords and with a couple of little holes here and there. And then somehow I started singing Bebopalula over it, and it worked, even the little spaces. It all worked, even though I made up some of my own lyrics as it went on. But then I realized all the tracks that I hadn't finished yet, I could sing Bebopalula over all of these, you know? And it would work. It's like, but it, you know, and I'm still doing it to this day. It's you know, it's a three-chord song, but, you know, I eliminated one of the chords. I don't think I could do it with three chords now, but.
Willie, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure, please.
I've always wondered, and maybe, and actually it's two parts.
I'd like to take my coat off, but all this junk's in it, the microphones.
We can hear you. I say from the first row.
This is for the posterities. For the people down the road.
You can take
cheap seats.
Okay. There's a little microphone.
I got it.
Oh, you got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you can put it on this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can put that in your pocket.
I'm sorry, Susan.
You can ask questions.
Yeah, please, everybody ask questions. Because
my question is that for you, do you write the words first or the melody? And also, is there a standard way to do it, whether or not you do it that way? I mean, I've always wondered about this.
I thought there was standard ways. I mean, when I first started writing what I thought was songs, it was before I was really into what I thought was poetry. But I probably thought though some of those songs were poetry. But I would use forms like blues form where you repeat the first line twice and you had come up with a third line. And to write songs sometimes, I don't have one method for any three songs, it seems. Sometimes like, oh, I woke up with this melody in my head, or I had a dream about these lyrics, and I did have like one called Ocean's Condo. And made this video called Bass Rocks and stayed in this place on Rocky Neck in this, like, you know, where the people stay, whatever. It's like, not a hotel, but like a
flop house.
Well, no, tourists and stuff. Combinations. And so I'm, you know, waking up and all these words are coming to me and I'm scribbling them down. And, like, you know, three, and the words were like, go to sleep now, baby, in the belly of a whale, you know. I ain't Sinbad the sailor. I don't want to go to jail. I'm not Jonah and the whale and all this stuff. And in the ocean's condo, all this stuff. And like, you know, a month later, or maybe what was it, 10 years later or something, the whole thing went into the ocean. So, you know, maybe it was prophetic. So, you know, you gotta watch out. But dreams are good for lyrics. That's one place to get lyrics. And well, these days and for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, you know, I always have little notebooks and I'm always scribbling stuff down and I don't know when I'm going to use it. Sometimes, you know, I'll have a melody in my head, not often. And often I'll come up with a chord progression, just some kind of riff or something. And I'll hang on to that until something will work with it. And I've had some forms that I've been playing for years that I haven't recorded yet. And I said, well, I had one called this name, Yuda.
Yuda. Yuda.
But now it's
Clara.
So that's after 40 years, I
Clara. So glad to meet you.
You know. But it might take another 10 years before I get another big revelation. I mean, these are all real people, but I've just switched it along. So, you know, I don't have one method, but a lot of times, the thing that I think that really helped me write songs was after I finished my stint with the Velvet Underground, which I was in for a little while. I had like enough money to buy a sound on sound tape recorder. Once I had that sound on sound tape recorder, I could build tracks. I could put a piano down and then go upstairs, and I had a snare drum and a bass drum, and I would overdub those. And every time I would add another percussion thing, I would, you know, I'd sing something, but it still didn't, or I'd, you know, I'd be making noises or whatever. And I'd build these tracks and then try this set of lyrics or that, and just, I never knew what would end up where. So that doesn't answer your question, but a lot of times, you know, I'll have a form and or somebody say, hey, you know, I got this song, man, you wanna put some lyrics to it, which doesn't happen very often. But so yeah, give it to me, and I'll listen to it 2,000 million times, and then some will be right. Or a rhythm, it's, you know, I have a rhythm or something more than I'll have a whole song in my head.
Well, to that point, you started as a drummer, right? And Cuban rhythms are very important to you. How important is rhythm to
rhythms
to you writing the song? Is that
I write rhythmically. It's like, you know, I used to think when I was reading all this poetry, all these beat guys, but I was reading some of this Robert Creeley stuff, and it's like, he's got these really careful, like so many lines, it's like haiku almost, you know, and it's like, oh, I'm counting syllables and it's gotta just be just right. And I was really trying to mathematically put things together. And when I write to a track, I try and, you know, make it work that way. But you know, that's good, but it's like not all poetry is symmetrical. Like, you know, it's like when I did Vincent's stuff, it wasn't like Chuck Berry or anything where it's just, you know, and he's a great example of swinging right along and telling a story. But a lot of my songs, I guess they are stories, and I don't make them up. So it's like, that's not, I don't write songs, I trip over them, I think. It's like they're real people, a lot of them, and I just happen to write about them. And then it's like, Dirty Eddie's my best friend. It sounds like a square dance, dude. And I'm making it up that way. And then it comes out on the record, and it's like, wham! And it's like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, wham! And it's like, Dirty Eddie's my best friend. It changes up when you show it to somebody else sometimes. But, you know, originally I thought it was going to be like a square dance or something. Like, oh, shit. But,
Willie, how do the bands that you play with sort of affect the final arrangements like that? Do you actually invite people to contribute? Do they just say, hey, I think we should do this here? Or?
Well, when I was in The Lost, I was kind of like the utility rhythm guy. I only sang maybe 2 or 3 songs. I did harmony, and I played claves, I played kunga drum, I played cowbell, I played tambourine. They finally got me piano when they realized I really could play it, because we did a commercial. Our manager had us do it, the old Gillette look sharp, feel sharp, be sharp thing, and we made a track in Revere. I said, wow, you can play the piano. So they got me a Hohner piano, and so I started playing electric piano on stage. But, and I was playing, and then after The Lost, I played drums in a band. I didn't want to, you know, somehow I just needed to change.
Did you ever play guitar? Do you write on a guitar at all?
Well, in the bunker, Dirty Eddie and I, we'd jam in this place. And it was like for a shoe factory or leather factory or something. And so all these boxes, and we had all these boxes piled, and you have to crawl inside all of these boxes. It was like a little hut, and he had his drums in there. And somebody had left a an acoustic guitar in this cellar. And so I would pick that up, and I sort of figured 3 chords, and it was kind of bluesy, so I'd bang on it. But it was like, and for lyrics, it was like, it was a pornographic novel, and so I'd use that for lyrics, which is always good. I mean, some of my lyrics are somewhat pornographic, but, you know, it's like this one had, how deep can I go here? I'm seeing. Some of my songs have like, you know, if you don't write them out, people don't know what you're singing about. It's like my song Kerouac, when I first was playing that for people, they thought, oh, Cadillac, oh, Caroline, oh, and Johnny Thunders, the New York guitar player, he was a friend of house, this Ready Teddy house, and he came in, and I had just got my box of 45s, and we're playing them, because we're just like, hey, this is it, Mass Ave and Kerouac. Played Kerouac for me. I said, Kerouac, was that cough syrup? Because in the line in the song, you're on the top of my shelf. So even I see medicine cabinet, Kerouac, it made perfect sense. So that was closest. But, you know. So, you know, it doesn't matter what your lyrics are sometimes. You know, if you write them out, it spoils it because people come back at you with like, oh, that song about the, and you go, oh, yeah? You know? And I have this song called Looking Like a Bimbo, and played this biker bar with the Rhythm Assholes, which was a famous Beverly band that I was in for a while. And there was these bikers, and they said, do that song Feeling Like a Dildo. Like, oh, I knew what they meant, and we just played it right away. So, you know, people hear what they want to hear. It could be very innocent or not. It could be, you know, totally not innocent.
Willie.
And I have some totally not innocent ones that are. You just change the titles from, you know, something that sounds nasty to something sweet, and it gets by. That's a good trick, too.
Willie.
What?
So how exactly, like, do you take, like, your stories and everything and then, like, put them into lyrics? Like...
Well, it's like these, I made a list of some of the, where'd my glasses go? Real people songs. And it's like, you know, it's trial and error to get the right chords sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you don't have a melody and stuff like that. I mean, where's the list? Here's the list. Real people, like real things, like, it's almost like, oh, this is like a whole bunch of stuff, and there's more. I know there's more. I just looking through album covers. Dirty Eddie, real person. Ted Dunford, he's a drummer friend. Preacher Jack, I just finished one about him. He's a real guy.
Friday Night.
Taxi Stand Diane was a girl who hung around and liked cab drivers in the Hyannis. I heard. And then Shopping Cart Louie, I heard about him when I went to Lowell to play, and he was a street guy that got murdered by, you know, some kids for who knows what. You know, and so I wrote a song about him. My friend Swine was my friend Swine, which that was his real name too. His real name was Stephen Lovelace. He had a band called the Lovelace Lads, which I was an honorary drummer of, and I would sing with sometimes. And Scott Baronwall was in that band sometimes, and Matthew McKenzie, Fred Buck's Footsteps. He's a hero of mine in Gloucester. And that song is like, that's not a song even. That's like it's like a friggin' novel. It's like it's so long. And it was just all improvised. But I had two chords, which was like, you know, Fred Buck's Footsteps, my friend. Fred Buck's Footsteps, which is like, you know, look, your love life or something. A lot of times, progressions can be stolen from somewhere or borrowed. It's like some of my more famous songs, I like to use the word steal, but, you know. It's like, you know, that place on Kenmore Square, The Rat. I have a song called At the Rat. But in the 50s, it was At the Hop. So people could say, oh, yeah, right, Willie. You know, but, you know, and I have a song called Mass Avenue. So you can take forms, and I just think of them as ready-mades. And you can, it's like, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, sometimes you have to play, like, you're playing in bars, and you got to play some covers. Because you can play your original stuff all night, and they're going, hurr. And then you play Louie Louie, and then you just think, you guys are gods. And they just love it. And I can see, because they just know that one. And then maybe in the 70s, we're playing all these original songs. So we're sneaking them in. I joined this cover band because I like some of the musicians in it. And there's a girl singer, and she just split after a while because we're working more of our own material than Matthew McKenzie and me and Scott Baronwall. But... what am I leading up to? Jesus. material. Oh yeah, the song in the early 70s, the one that's like where they would start bowing and saying, "You guys are tremendous," would be like, we'd do Grand Funk Railroad. One of theirs. And it was fun to do this stuff. You know, there was an I Am Your Captain and some kind of bullshit. But like, you know, people were digging it, so it's like, you know, that's fun, making people smile. You know, and you can do it with your own songs, it's even better. But, you know, a lot of times it's ready-made. It's like, you know, the Beach Boys. Did a tour of the Beach Boys in 1966, The Lost did. And, you know, they have a lot of famous songs. And one of them is Fun, Fun. Fun, 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 and I don't know how it goes. It's like, fun, 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 take your daddy takes your T-bird away, yay, blah, blah, blah. So I did my East Coast version of it, but I call it Mass Avenue. So it's like, you know, instead of like, you take your daddy's car and you get to the hamburger stand now. You know, whatever, you know. And I always mess up the chords on this every time I play it, even to this day. Maybe because I didn't write this progression, or because, well, I wasn't drunk when I recorded the track. I was drunk when I did the vocal on it, the original vocal. And it's like, wow, he's got quite a technique on this one. Because it's like, oh, my God. I'm weaving in and out from the microphone. And it creates a certain aura. And Lester Bangs liked it a lot. And he called my singing sleazy, which I took as a really good compliment. I liked what he would say about me.
Would you talk about how drugs and alcohol have affected you?
Sure. I drank maybe for the first 20 years of my career, and then I stopped drinking in 85. But I have notebooks, and I have boxes full of notebooks of scribble that, you know, when I was still drinking, I'd go to these bars, and I would just, you know, drinking whiskey and cheap whiskey and scribbling. But most of those scribbles, I can't read them, for one thing. And a lot of it is just, it isn't so good. I mean, I don't think I've used too many of those drunken things. Other drugs, marijuana is a good one for connecting the dots. I think it just puts a bright light on things sometimes. But I'd recommend that over the alcohol as far as composition. You know, it's good. I mean, the first time I probably got high with musicians in a car, and it's like every line coming out of me was rhyming and stuff like that. So, you know, but it didn't happen all the time. So maybe you're always chasing that, like, oh, I'm a great songwriter now, kind of thing.
When you stopped drinking, you didn't have like a problem connecting with your creative side.
Well, there's no creative side. I told you, I just the songs, I just trip over them on the street.
Well, that's creative.
They're real people. I mean,
so you didn't have any problem tripping over them on the street then? Let me put it that
no. People weren't tripping over me.
Have you ever had a period where you weren't writing and you were?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes like it's like, you know, when I decided to be a front man and do the and I put that 45 out. I didn't have a band when I put out Mass Ave, but I was sitting in with all these bands because they're all my friends, and I'd sing two songs with this band because they were easy to teach them, and I'd sing with this band and that band. I was singing with a half a dozen bands. And then one of the managers of one of the bands says, Willie, you sleazebag, why don't you get your own band? You know? And then there was a battle of the bands. And then I borrowed a whole band and used them. And we won the battle of the bands. And they decided to stay with me. So it worked out. But when I decided, you know, I don't know if I decided or just, it was just circumstance that I was, you know, I mean, I sang lead in The Lost, but the Boom Boom Band was the first band where it was all material that I had written, and I sang all the songs. So that was like a first time with that kind of deal. But, you know, most of the songs that I sang with that band, I wrote before I met them. So I had all this material, so when I met them, I just, you know, I taught them, you know, enough songs so we could do the Battle of the Bands, and then we just kept going, and I had more. And so for that first, as they say, you know, your first album, it takes your whole life to write that, and then the next album's harder. But I mean, I had all the material already, but then I started writing more songs when I had the Boom Boom Band. But 3 years was the longest for any band, you know, except for the Persistence of Memory Orchestra. And I think the secret to that was that we never saw each other. We didn't live together, and we just got together to record or play shows and just played music together. There wasn't all this hanging out stuff and starving together and all that, and, you know, all that social stuff. So I think, not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's happened that way.
How did the Velvet Underground thing come up, and how did it fall apart, or how did it go?
Well, I was in a band called the Grass Menagerie. Grass Menagerie, yeah. It was 1967. And
when did you move back to Gloucester, and why?
Why? Had to get out of Somerville. No, I left Somerville. But I was in Gloucester when I was a boy, you know.
Cape Ann rules, baby.
Yeah, and I love Gloucester, Washington Square. But
what was the year that you moved back?
Moved back? Yeah. June of 97. I know there was a question about the Velvet Underground. There was a guy named Doug Yule who was one of the many revolving players in this Grass Menagerie. I was the drummer, and he came in as a bass player, I think. I mean, it was like two or three guitars. It was like, man, this is awful. I mean, you know, guys would come in and out all the time. It's like teaching the material to the next guy. It was really a drag.
Is he a New York guy?
No, he was Boston at the time.
Because I've got Max's Live at Kansas City. J.J. Cale's on, but are there Yule brothers?
Yeah, that's Billy Yule. He ended up playing drums instead of Mo when she was having her baby.
Yeah, they're on that.
But he had me come into the band. He said, we got to, you know, Lou Reed had left. And he got Walter Powers, who was in a band, two or three bands with me. He was in the Grass Menagerie and he was in the Lost. First they got Walter to come in and play bass because John Cale left. And then, so okay, there's two guys from Boston I know there. And then Sterling Morrison left at one point, and he said, let's get Willie. So it's like, come on, man, you gotta join. We got this tour, and it'd be like old times, you know, because we used to jam and stuff. I said, yeah, it sounds good, but like you should change the name of the band because, you know, Lou Reed's not there. But, you know, they never did that. And it almost didn't matter, which was weird. But, you know, most of that material, you know, it came out another, you know, like 20 or 30 years later, you know, on a Japanese label and a huge box set with like wonderful color photographs. The photographs are great, but you know, I used to get cassettes of all these gigs that we played. There were all these schools in England and stuff, and when I joined that band, I didn't know the songs. I barely knew what the Velvet Underground was about. You know, I have a sheet of paper. I said, you know, I'm begging Doug, just give me the chords on some of these songs since we're going to play this festival, you know? And so at one point it says, fuck it, fake it. And it's like, you know, the D to this or that. So I got little, you know, which didn't do much good because it's like, you know, I have to look at my fingers because I never learned properly in reading music. So it's like, so I had a cheat sheet kind of, but I was ending up just, you know, doing all kinds of noise and, you know, my jazz influence and just playing like free sometimes. But, you know, I would listen to these and I didn't like them, but I'm softening up and I can listen to sometimes. There's a song on there that, you know, that I just recorded, finally really recorded. You know, it's a good one. But
hey,
I mean,
Willie, oh, sorry. Am I interrupting you?
Mm-mm. I need questions.
What came first in your life, music or words?
It's I think music more than the words. I mean, I always pile up lyrics in different notebooks and stuff, and I'll have a progression because I had that tape recorder, or you know, I could record something and then just listen to it and say what will fit. And so it's like matching up stuff. It's not all together. It's very rarely that I have the words and the melodies and all that come together. And then for a long time, I probably wasn't even thinking about melodies. I was, you know, because I was listening to all this rap music and everything, and it was more just, it was just rhythms and stuff. But, you know, I know how important melodies are. And my stepfather was a musician, and, you know, I play my stuff for him. And he liked the ballads. He said, it's the slow, pretty songs. Those are the ones. And I was like, okay, you know, that's what he always said, no matter what I played for him, I could, you know. And he, you know, he's probably right. I mean, I don't know. With my reputation, some would have known for slow ones or fast ones. But I tell you, it's the slow ones that get people more than the fast ones, because it just happens that way. I think that's the way people are. You know, there's rhythms, but it's the slow, pretty ones always. You know, And you can do a slow, pretty one on top of a fast beat, too. You can mix it up. Mix it up is a good thing.
Do you ever get to, like, nonsense rhymes in your head?
Well, sometimes I know what you mean, and then write real words later.
Yeah.
I really haven't done that method, but I think sometimes when I, you know, was the front man and all that, my best moments were nonverbal. They weren't the words, they were the heavy breathing and, like, you know, stuff like that, and just yelps and moans and groans. And totally nonverbal. Well, James Brown is a good example of how abstract and how great. I mean, sometimes it'd be just one chord or two chords, and he's just screaming or moaning, and it's like, this is music, and this is fantastic. You know, you don't need the verse, chorus, verse. You don't need these formats. But, you know, I used those formats on a few songs, but those are the ones that I kind of lifted, you know, like fun, 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 and I wrote my own lyrics to it. So, yeah, this is the East Coast version. But, you know, I think my masterpiece from the 70s was on the Live at the Rat album, and it's just a thing called Pup Tune, which is P-U-P-U-P, the puked up poochie panty tune. What they call it, Pop Tune on the French albums. But, and I had a beginning, and I had an end. It's Latin break that I taught the Boom Booms. And they got the break at the end. We didn't get the breaks at the beginning, but it's a good thing because the rest of it is wonderful, and it's all just kind of improvised. And a lot of that is just, not that I recommend getting drunk and going out and performing, but I know I probably was pretty loaded, but I can always tell when I listen to the you know, my drinking years music. I used to throw away a lot of these cassettes when people give them because it's like, oh, Jesus. You know, I thought I had singing, I had a style, but I sounded like Gabby Hayes. I sound like I have a mouthful of potatoes, and I'm going, blah, blah, blah. And I thought it was wonderful, but it really was awful. So I would just throw away half. If it's something like the Whiskey A Go-Go we played, had to play two sets a night. First set was great. Second set was like after an hour of another band and people and just all kinds of shenanigans. So that second set was always like, hold your breath. And they'd even take my piano out of the mix. It was like I was playing all the wrong chords. You know, that second set stuff just didn't work for me. You know, luckily, you know, as time went on, people didn't have to play like two or three sets. They could just go on and play 20 minutes or for one set. And you know, even if you're half shattered, it might come out all right. But and I don't recommend heavily. I mean, when I was in the 60s, I used to drink wine. I used to drink whatever. I used to mix scotch and coke because John Lennon did, and then whiskey and coke because P.J. Proby did. And it's like you get your heroes, and all my heroes were alcoholics and drug addicts. So, you know, you had to try everything at least once or twice or more. But I don't recommend that for everybody. But, you know, you just got to do what you got to do.
So your newspapers, your walls, your movies all rely a lot on collage and sort of patchworking the interesting bits together. Do you do the same thing in your songwriting?
Yeah. a lot of the stuff in the last 20 years or more just put together like puzzles, a piece of this. I mean, I'll go in like with Tony, you know, I'm recording at Bang a Song Studios, and it's underneath CBS. It's like 2 minutes from my house. And, you know, we'll make a track. And the tracks would be like, I'll go in and they have a set of drums there. I can play drums. So I play drums for 20 minutes or something. And we'll cut a piece out of that and make a loop out of it. And okay. And add a piano to that. And you got a groove, you know. Loops are the thing these days. And then I try this or that. And I take it home and say, oh, and I'll try this. And, oh, this doesn't work at all. So it's the thing on the other page that works. So it's all kind of chance, except for, the, you know, the new one with the Raztones where I kind of had songs when I went in, which was different for me. I mean, I had songs when I went to the studio. You had to in the 70s and in the 60s. But from the solo date, when I started making solo albums and stuff, I was going in and screwing around and finding stuff and making stuff up. And, you know, it all depended on and sometimes I'd make a track and sing a vocal over it and then take the whole track out and just I have this one called Up for This, which is like four lines, and it's like, I didn't grow up for this. I don't want to look like this. I don't want to look at this. I didn't grow up for this. And I had this line like a Little Richard, do, 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 like a whoa, 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 miss. And I had that for a bassist, and I played the drums, and I had Peter Dayton was coming in to pay a bill. I had him play guitar on it, and I had bass, and it was all normal. And I listened to it and said, take all that stuff out. And he had this synthesizer, and it made noises like mosquitoes and insects and just this weird shit. I said, yeah, let's use that. And took out the steady rhythm and just had like a stop rhythm, like boom, doom, 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 boom, doom, doom, doom. So it was like this staccato stop rhythm instead of a flowing rhythm, and it made the lyrics stand out more. But it's like, you know, a hornet's nest in the background. But you know, it sounded great to me. And he didn't really remix it too much. Next. I think I'm rolling here. I don't know how I'm doing. Am I answering any questions about my secrets?
I've got a question. I just had this epiphany tonight at the Gloucester Writers Center that the confluence of rhythm and blues and rock and roll is Americana. But I think you'd probably be best known for the Boom Boom Band,
right?
Which is probably punk. Is that punk rock?
You know, they were calling it. I mean, every band in Boston was different from it, just like in New York. Punk was a term like, you know, like a fad term when they started using it. But, you know, I don't know, it was my I accepted some of that because, maybe because of my bratty attitude. You know, which I was a mess during that first second phase of my you know,
musical
incarnation. Yeah. I mean, I was bad. I was so, you know, they're always gonna. But I'm really avoiding that question.
Well, the reason that I ask is because Americana roots music. Oh,
that's what,
yeah,
I love.
Nashville and Muscle Shoals, but I find that this area,
I always thought my stuff,
not as practitioners.
My stuff is East Coast. I was always East Coast, as opposed to, like, because when we went to California, it's like, who are these guys kidding with this, you know, Eagles crap? I just didn't like any of that stuff,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
You know, I liked it. It's like, the New York, bands were better, like the Rascals were better than the Beach Boys, but I liked the Beach Boys. That was a secret thrill, but, you know, I still like the Beach Boys. Well, I don't know about that now. They're not doing much.
They're playing tomorrow night at the Big Casino.
I played there with the Grass Menagerie.
Really?
Jeez.
They're
on the way down, huh?
Yeah. I think rather than being a punk band, Willie has a punk sensibility where it's more grassroots. I mean, to take what you're saying, I think it's more pulling from all the different traditions and not, I mean, the punk sensibility is about just grabbing and using whatever is good.
Yes, and sort of rewriting the rules. It's like, well, the record companies really don't care about me, so it's like, well, fuck them. You know, I'm going to put out my own records.
That was
very important to me. You know, and when I put out Mass Ave, it was just me and maybe one other band or two other bands that were making their own 45s. I mean, everybody thought the dream is to get on the big labels, but, you know, I'd been on three of them in the 60s, and it wasn't like the end of the world. You ended up fighting with them, and you're hating the mix of your song and stuff like that. So, you know, with the so-called punk movement, people was starting to get more control over the product, if you want to call it that.
How about the avant side, Willie? I saw that in Persistence of Memory and in the...
Well,
I start hearing a pretty outside thing, particularly in the lyrics, and I wonder
lyrics,
think about
really.
That or some of them.
I didn't think about the lyrics, but with that band, the drummer could play just a variety of beats, whereas most of the rock and roll drummers that I played with are all great, but they could only play certain beats. But this guy could play African beats, he could play samba beats, and he could play jazz. So it made me sound great. I mean, I'm always just me with my lyrics and my voice, and it was just changing the whole environment for me. And I also had to get away from guitars for a while because my hearing was shot. and so forth. And I, you know, it's like, you know, you're playing loud music, and that's great, but it's like when you start a song and people are leaving the room, it's like really kind of counterproductive, you know, and that would happen. It doesn't happen now because everybody wears earplugs and the sound guys are all deaf too. And they all wear earplugs. That's, I guess, a joke. I don't know. But but it, you know, when things are too loud, it's not pleasant. I mean, I'd be playing on stage with some of these bands, and you know, my piano's in one spot. So while I'm playing that, maybe I'm have to, you know, the guitar amp's behind me, and you know, the sound check, and that as soon as, and they all, I love them all dearly, but it's like, and the sound guy says, oh. You got to turn that amplifier on. You got to put a coat over that. Say, yeah. As soon as the gig comes, like, just doesn't matter. It's just put everything on 10 and play for the night, you know. And it's okay while you're on stage, you know, but the sound checks were hell. I hated sound checks because that's when I could feel all the loud noises, you know. But you know, so I kind of got away from the guitars. But then when I got back in, it's like there's nothing like it. There's nothing like the power and the glory of all that massive noise, and it's your noise, you know. So it's like, you know, but I think I just had to give it a break. But I like it, made a man out of me. It made me play with two hands on the piano and stuff like that.
Kind of personal question, but
and you couldn't hear it with all the guitars.
Your dad is a preacher. Did he ever see you play?
No. He died when I was 13 or 14. 14.
Did the church and that experience have any influence on your music?
Well, I liked a lot of those hymns.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it wasn't like he was into rock and roll. I can remember driving back from Cape Cod once, and maybe it was 1956 or 57, and Roll Over Beethoven came on the radio, you know, the great Chuck Berry song. He turned the thing up, and he was like, beating on the dashboard and stuff, and he's digging it. It's like, holy shit. So, you know, he never put it down or anything, you know. So I'm grateful for that. But shall I play you something? Play a song or play?
Play. Yeah.
Or illustrate something? I had all these.
Are you feeling any more questions?
Huh? No, I don't. I wish I could. So, you know, so you're right about
Sabbath. There we go.
That one, it's like, if I could play it without messing it up, it would be really great. So it's like, if the less chords you put in the song, the less mistakes you'll make. That's a good tip. And nowadays, it's like, well, since, like, you know, punk rock and all that, it's like, you didn't have to have all these, you know, it's okay to just play three chords or two chords. Right now, with world music, it's like a lot of this, like, Indian music and it's African music, and it's like, it's the rhythmic textures, you know, you know, you really don't need a lot of chords. Sometimes I think people, I love Hoagy Carmichael. He was like, I loved watching him smoke cigarettes and play the piano in the movies. The Stardust, the introduction to Stardust has more chords in it than my entire repertoire. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but you know, I love Hoagy.
Are there any contemporary acts that you like?
Yeah. Can't think of them right now.
But
no,
they're out there.
Usually, it's the women singers that get to me more than the guys.
Yeah.
You know, for some reason, I like that. What's her name? Lord. I liked a couple of hers. She has good lyrics, but I never really heard any more than one or two songs. But you know, I buy a lot of stuff and I bring it home and I play it from Mystery Train. But it's like, you know. I listen to everything. It's like I don't listen to the radio, like college radio, like I used to. You know, I used to listen to it every morning and every afternoon. It's not important to me anymore for some reason. I don't know what it is.
It's changed.
The things I listen to are usually the things I'm working on, you know.
With your lyrics, there's a lot of place and real life people. Is there any poetry that influences your lyrics? I mean, I think of you kind of as a New York school type lyricist. I mean, like the poetry.
Well,
you know, just putting
yeah.
the stuff you know, the people you know.
Yeah.
Not
well, being. You know, reading guys like Jack Kerouac, he's writing about his neighborhoods and things like that, and it's like saying it's okay to write about your life, And, you know, the big guy, the big O, was always writing about Gloucester. So it's like, that's the only reason I could continue reading him, because I didn't understand most of it, but I knew where the Sawyer Free Library was and stuff like that. And, you know, so it kept me going. And I ended up recording two of his poems. I recorded one of his poems, Garrett Lansing poems. It's like, and I did a whole album of, and I never thought I was going to be doing anybody else's stuff, you know, but it was like, you know, it happened. It was suggested to me. And it's like, you don't always take suggestions. Like you said, collaborating with other people with your materials. Like, you know, I had these band, I have these songs and I'll show them to the band. And if they want to change anything, oh, Jesus, this is my baby. This is a masterpiece. Change what? You know? And then maybe 3 days later, it's like, oh, that's a good idea. You know, and then you accept it, but it, like, not right away. It never works.
Who would you like to collaborate with most today?
I don't know.
Anybody come to mind?
I mean, real people? Collaborate with a lot of ghosts. Probably like to collaborate maybe with like more like non-musicians because it would be different, you know. But I mean, I don't think about it. But, you know, that's the stuff that's usually good is the stuff you don't think about, stuff that just happens. I wanted to play something. What I don't even know what time it is.
Time
to do what? I could play a little bit of what I thought was my masterpiece from At the Rat. Yeah. You guys are all familiar with that album, right?
Yeah.
It's finally on a CD. So I'll just play a little bit. It's like, and this song would be a good example of like a medley. I mean, this little bit of a poem here and this. And it's like three or four things at the beginning of the song that I had written down and nothing else after a certain point. And then it's just, to me, in those days, I was trying to get to this point where it's almost nonverbal. I called it Gaga back then. You know, it was like Willy Loco Boom Boom Gaga is the name of this. And it's like, you know, it's stuff from 75 to 91. This is like, you know, predates Lady Gaga. But, you know, the Queen came out with a Gaga song, and Matthew McKenzie had Gaga in the lyrics. Gaga's an old thing. It's like, you know, Skeezix or something. Okay, so this is Pop Tune. I mean, this is not a good example of how to write songs, but this is a great progression. You can write a million songs out of this progression. Just like, you know, it's just E flat, A flat, B flat. And that's it, and the same amount of bars on all of them. But before going back to the E flat, sometimes towards the middle and to the end of the song, the guitar player plays a D flat, and it's like whoa, and it makes all the difference. And rhythmically, I mean, this, you know, I could never repeat this except for the stuff that was written down, you know. And I'd always just improvise different stuff to it, but. This is it. We kind of mess up the beginning, but it doesn't matter. It's supposed to have like a line and then boom, and then boom, boom. And that doesn't happen. But it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Where is it? Okay, number 8. So this is Pop Tune. And it's hilarious. The words are hilarious. It's, you know, it's about a dog throwing up panties and it's like, what the hell is he writing about? People like this stuff, but when I got my big deal with the record company, it was like, we don't want to do any of this. That one actually got airplay, but the record was in France, so you couldn't buy it here. There's Mass Ave. Does this sound like the Beach Boys? This is the one I can tell where the vocal is like. Butterfly on your right shoulder, hop into the gold, oh man. He weaves a little bit here. So you could sing fun. That's style. Here's it. You're good. We'll have fun through the galley, different scene. Oh yeah. And the reason that the bass and the drums come in there is because the engineer forgot to push something up. So it's like we got the record, we're mixing, it's like, that's where it has to be. But then we worked it into the arrangement. It's like, wow, this is great dynamics, man. You know, but it was all a mistake. But, you know, so those, the mistakes are the, you know, it's like most of my good chords are mistakes. So I'll play a pop tune. I mean, really, seriously. I would buy chord books sometimes to try and be legit. But man, I, you know, it's like, okay, this is the this kind of a chord, and these are the inversions and aversions and perversions of it. And it's like, oh, I'm getting a real headache here. So I'd get like three versions of it, and it's like, wow, this sounds so cool. So I'd get what sounded like a nice progression, and I'd just put the book down for another 4 years or something. You know, so I'm a really bad student.
Willie, when you were in that place where you were finding these interesting places and chords and everything, did you write them down? Because how would you remember them?
I have to tape them. And then hopefully you could find them. Well, it's like, you know, I had my 70th birthday and guys are playing material from, like, I don't even remember that I had written. And it's like, I had to ask him for the chords. I had to ask Roger Miller, what were the chords to Working Hard? It's like, I thought I knew, and I thought it was really simple, but I didn't, you know. So it's like, you forget, unless you play them all the time. Okay, here's the masterpiece. Can you hear that? That's probably Johnny Ray roll that stuff.
I wanna go five flags up like Maybelline. I wanna giggle late nights up living out of a dream.
I passed out Miss Veronica. But the creature from the Black Lagoon was a love buffoon. Here's the panty part. This is a red setter. So, you know, as a performer, I love singing this stuff. Because it's like, with horror. So from here on in, it's all. And I realized I stole this part from that comedian, Mama Papa, Alan Sherman or something. This whole lick. It's like, oh man. That's the falsetto. No words. This is like Liszt, sort of. This is pseudo-Spanish stuff, because I love Afro-Cuban music. So I'm just talking about all the Titos. Tumbadoras are drum. Love Seals, too. That kind of stuff. Space is good. A little theme. I love Phil Spector. Baby, I love you. Ronnie Spector. I thought I was her some nights. And that was a good thing. And it's people in the audience, you know, approaching the song. I can tell how drunk I am, how the pictures. It was pretty, I know I was drinking, but it's not totally off. I didn't throw this one away. That's my whole thing. It's not writing songs, it's just rhythm. Rhythm is the whole thing. You can get away with anything. Donna Summers. Boston Sound. I must have swallowed my gum. I did try and sing into a gum. But you know, this is my music, but you not, don't hear that stuff on Top 40 radio, but man, it's a blast to do it, you know? So a lot of my stuff, now that's sampling myself and throwing it on something else. And this is another true story about a guy who was killed in a bar. This is off just a loop. After this, I'm almost out of these. The record company, you know, when they went out of business, they said, "Willie, we got boxes of these things, and we'll give you a deal on it." I'm almost out of them now. There's a song about Gloucester. Here's one that could come back as a hit, probably. It's called SOS. So I should start doing this one again, since you know heroin's bad. I first heard about Vincent Farina in the newspaper talking about this problem in a Boston newspaper.
There's heroin in Gloucester. It's in my hometown. It's back to me. Overdoses, word is getting round. It started in the 60s. It kills mothers. It kills kids. It's come out in the open. It's too big to keep it hid.
Eric Lindgren gave me these two chords. He was a good guy to work with. He would modulate a lot of my stuff so that I couldn't even play it. Now you have to play the piano. Just like Dunkin' Donuts. $7, you get high now. Seems like it's happening everywhere, even in Vermont, for God's sake. Everywhere. Right. Emotion's always good in a song if you can get an emotion. Or make people feel something. Great guitar player, Rupert Webster. I call this style of guitar playing wounded animal. Sound like dinosaur fights and stuff. This one's actually pretty musical, but my friend Eric, you know, he got this whole vamp where it goes down some kind of thing that he wrote out, and he got a cellist in there, and he had a charge form, the whole works. I mean, my stuff's really simple. Sometimes he could make it a little more better by his knowledge that I didn't have. Like, here's an example. I have this song called Like Trash, and it's just like a Spanish mode. And then it goes to this. But I was doing something, and he said, "No, go down with the left hand." So it went like that. Dissonance just makes it good, you know. So it's like I could play a lot of my songs are like just two lines, and you just repeat them, because repetition is the key. So you don't have a lot. Like my first record had you know 10,000 lyrics, but it's like they're gone in a minute. But so.
People throw each other away like trash. Like trash. people throw each other away like trash, like trash. For a little money, for a little cash, for a little honey. Don't be afraid to use a whole hand on a piano. For a piece of ass. Saxophone comes in and goes nuts, and Jim Daugherty's going nuts on the drum, so it's like, okay, I better use the foot pedal on this, and so I can mush them together and go and do all the Cecil Taylor stuff. So you know, there's a two-liner. Some of my songs, well, it's like the Vincent album, a lot of his poems that I used were just one line, but you know, how do you do that for 3 minutes? You just repeat them. Sing them a little different this second time around. Should I play? Should I play a whole song? Any requests? Play a Vincent one? Okay. Easy. It says house. here's a good Vincent one. With the Vincent Farini stuff, Henry originally asked me after Vincent had passed, and there was going to be a memorial service at City Hall. I said, Willie, maybe you could, you know, try and put some music to some of his stuff. And I hadn't thought of that. So, you know, I kind of looked in some things and I tried a few things. And I didn't actually end up recording any of those, but I used some of those. And I did about six songs. And the goal was to get them played at Virgilio's, because they have, you know, Vincent was Italian-American, and all the music they play in there is like, you know, it's Italian-American music, usually by, you know, pop stars and stuff like, you know, Dean Martin and people like that. I said, maybe if I get, you know, fit some Vincent stuff in there. So I was conscious of, like, not using, like, you know, throwing up panties and you know, all my usual stuff, because, like, people are trying to buy subs and food, and they get children in there. So I kept it pretty, you know, on the up and up. And I, you know, it's not, I don't go out of my way to, you know, write those things. It's just, you know, I just write them. But anyway, I worked my way up to some of his real greatest hits. He had some poems that were really significant for lots of people. Most of the stuff I just picked out because they caught my eye and I thought I could do something with it. It's not like it's my favorite poem or anything, or it's a big famous one. But this one was a big famous one. So I didn't think I was worthy of it after the first. I had to work my way up to it. But T-Max always asks for it when I play it at Giuseppe's. So
the gold.
The gold. This is the gold. The gold. This is the gold. I also used this progression on one other song, I have to admit to you. It was called New Siren in Abilene. Sorry, Vincent. I didn't, the other part was new. So okay, you can steal from yourself. That's, you know, and nobody ever heard New Siren in Abilene anyway. No, I don't remember that one. It's supposed to be four. I try and keep four bars in between each one of these chords, but it's really difficult. The suddenness flowers have styles the air with their fire and ether. The suddenness flowers have styles the air with their fire and ether. As we do with what is ours, because we are the gardeners of each other. As we do with what is ours, because we are the gardeners of each other. Probably minor chords. I never use minor chords. They always sound good. They always get people. As we do it, what is ours? Because we are the gardeners of each other. Maybe wrap it up with another Vincent one that's another two-liner, but maybe you guys can just repeat them with me. And if you can, beat out some kind of rhythm on your laps or on the floor. It's kind of free, but it's really kind of 6A, like, which is, or you could just sing, boom, 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 boom. Yeah.
Woo!
Woo! Woo! Thank you.